You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A Plus, in America's post-Roe world, doctors and prospective patients are concerned that fertility treatments could become the next target. Find out more today at 6 on 1A Plus. Now think back, if you encountered a live animal today, a dog or cat, squirrel or bird, mosquito or bee, did you see it, hear it, smell it? Did you stop and think about how that creature might have been sensing you? Our next guest says trying to imagine how other non-human animals experience the world we share can open us up to entirely new appreciations of our surroundings and the beauty and complexity of animals. He digs into the science of animal senses in a new book, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. What are the animals in your life that you see? Domestic, pets, barnyard, backyard, wild animals? Do you spend much time observing or trying to get to know them? What questions do you have about how animals experience and sense the world? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Ed Young is a science writer at The Atlantic and author of I Contain Multitudes, The Microbes Within Us, and A Grander View of Life. His newest book is called An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. Ed, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me again.
One word appears a lot in your book. It's a German word, Umwelt, and it's this idea of how animals perceive the world. Can you talk a little bit about that concept?
Yeah, the Umwelt is the particular slice of the world that each animal can perceive. The unique sets of sights and sounds and textures and smells that it's privy to, but that other creatures might not be able to sense. So we humans, for example, our Umwelt includes a lot of colors that my dog, for example, cannot see. But we cannot sense the Earth's magnetic field in the same way that a songbird might be able to. We can't sense a lot of colors that songbird can see. We can't sense the electric fields that a shark or a duck-billed platypus might be able to sense. Each creature is limited in its own way. And even though our senses give us this powerful illusion that we have a complete and total perception of the world, that very much is an illusion. We are all trapped in this specific sensory bubble, and that is what the Umwelt is.
Before we get into some specific senses, one thing that struck me is there's a lot of science looking at the way animals sense the world, and we know a lot, but we don't know a lot. There's a lot of frontiers in this field of study.
There's so much we don't know. I mean, people have been puzzling over this for millennia. But even then, new senses keep on being discovered. You know, things like echolocation, how bats use sonar to navigate their way around, was only discovered in the 40s. Magnetoreception, how animals sense the Earth's magnetic field, was only really known since like the 60s and 70s. And even now, there's so much we don't know. I think there's more unknown than known. And partly that's because each creature has its own Umwelt. So every animal out there is, you know, this whole other world for us to learn about and to imagine.
Let's start with an animal that a lot of us do get to witness in action using the sense a lot. Dogs and their sense of smell. First of all, talk about the mechanics. What's going on when a dog is smelling something that works maybe a little differently than we do?
Yeah, so all of the stuff inside the dog's nose and brain that's devoted to smell, the cells that pick up odors in the air, the neurons that send information to the brain, the parts of the brain that analyze those smells, there's just more of all of that stuff. But there are also certain like anatomical specializations in the dog's nose that make it just amazing at smelling. For example, when I inhale, all of the air rushes past my nose, but most it all then goes into my lungs. When I exhale, I blow out a lot of the odors that are then trapped in my nose. The dog actually splits that airflow into two so that there's a part that's devoted entirely to smell and doesn't go to the lungs. And so all the odors that a dog inhales just sits there. They're not constantly pushed out in the way that ours are. The dog's nose also, next time you look at your dog's nose, note that there are slits that go to the sides. The nostrils curve around. That's really special. So when a dog exhales, you might think that its breath pushes away odors on the ground in front of it. But in fact, those side slits create these little whirling vortices of air that sweep those odors into the nose. So regardless of whether the dog is inhaling or exhaling, it's getting this continuous conveyor belt of scent coming into its head.
We're talking to Ed Yong about his new book, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. You can join in if you have a question about how animals sense the world at 800-642-1234. If you have a dog and you want to share its story of hunting for smells, 800-642-1234 is the number. Ed, people might look at the dog's nostrils and say, aha, dogs are better at smelling than we humans, or they're twice as good at smelling as some other animal. One big takeaway I got from your book is it's really hard to compare better or worse in our sensory world.
Totally. Yeah. So when these numbers keep on cropping up, but what does it mean to be better at smelling, right? Do you smell a wider range of things? Can you detect them at smaller concentrations or from greater distances away? In some cases, humans actually perform just as well as dogs as discriminating between different odors, but dogs are just much better at using their noses. They're more experienced at it. They have that distinctive anatomy that I told you about that means that they're very good at sniffing continuously. And, you know, partly the difference is just very obvious to anyone who owns a dog. Like, we go outside, I walk around my neighborhood with my dog, Typo. He's a corgi. And, you know, the neighborhood seems the same to me. It doesn't seem to be changing all that often. But to him, every walk is an adventure because to his nose, things keep on changing all the time. Like new other dogs have walked past and left scent behind. They've peed on things. They've left scent in their footsteps. He can get all of that. And so when we go on walks, I start understanding that the world around me is actually changing in really dramatic ways that I can't perceive, but that he, with his nose, which he uses very well and knows how to use, really can perceive.
And a big bit of practical advice you give in the book is, if you have a dog, let it smell stuff. Could you talk about what that does for your dog?
Yeah, I think it's a shame that a lot of dog owners sort of yank dogs along on their walks. You know, they see the walk as a trip from A to B or purely about exercise. I think of the walk as a chance for the dog, for Typo to be a dog. And that means sniffing. Like if I, at least on one walk a day, he decides the pace of the walk, whatever he wants to sniff, with some small exceptions, he gets to sniff. And when we give him that agency, the walks take a long time. They're very slow. And I think that's good for him. You know, to deprive him of that is to deprive him of a huge part of his doghood. And there have been studies showing that dogs are happier, right, more optimistic, less anxious when they get a chance to really use their noses in the way that, in the way that they have evolved to.
Bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Jim is on the line. Jim, hi.
Hello. This is Jim.
And what do you want to ask about, Jim?
I want to ask I'm curious how dogs are able to discern like cancer or diabetes in a person. What is that sense involved? It seems such a minute change. What is going through their noses when they're able to figure that stuff out? Or how do they train them to even do that?
Jim, thanks for the call. It wasn't a healthcare thing, Ed, but you went to a fine scent training program for dogs.
Oh, I didn't, but one of the scientists I spoke
to right.
did. And yes, Jim is right. There have been a lot of studies showing that dogs can sniff out the scent of different diseases, everything from cancer to diabetes to even COVID. Now, whether that makes sense as a practical screening option in a medical setting, I'm a little dubious about, but it does show the amazing capacity of a dog's nose. And this really is just about smell. It's about the fact that disease changes the physiology of a person's body, and it changes the kinds of chemicals that we release from our skin. You know, all animals, all living things really are just leaking bags of chemicals. We all release scent, whether we like it or not. And things about our lives, our health, change the nature of that scent. Dogs can detect that, and the training them really just involves giving them a decent sample of healthy or sick individuals and letting their noses do their thing. And you know, this is it sort of reflects the kind of stuff that dogs do all the time. You know, we can train dogs to detect like explosives or drugs. You know, there are even dogs that scientists have trained to detect like the smell of whale poop so that they can find whales in the open ocean for their research. These are all sorts of, these all feel a little bit like parlor tricks to me, and they're incredible, but the dogs are doing this all the time. So when my dog goes on a walk and he's sniffing patches of pee that other dogs have left behind, I think that he can get stuff about their health, their you know, maybe what they've eaten recently, or all kinds of information that I wouldn't be able to get. And you know, to me, when he does that, it feels to me like me checking my social media feeds. You know, it's an update on what all the dogs in the neighborhood are up to and how well they're doing right now.
Thanks for the call, Jim. We're talking to Ed Yong about his new book, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. Do you have a question about how particular animals perceive the world, see, smell, feel, magnetify, you name it? Is there an animal you've observed and wondered, what the heck are they doing? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We've been talking about dogs and smell. We're going to get into some less familiar territory coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with science writer Ed Yong about his new book, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. You can join in with your questions at 800-642-1234. All right, Ed, let's check out a sense that we humans probably don't have, the ability to sense the Earth's magnetic field. A lot of species can do this, apparently.
Yeah, songbirds can do this. You know, a lot of the very simple birds that we see around us all the time have this ability. Sea turtles can do it. Some moths and very simple insects can do it. This ability it essentially gives them a built-in compass. It allows them to migrate over long distances and to keep their bearing without any other kind of landmark or any kind of hint. And you know, their abilities are truly extraordinary. You know, you can take a baby turtle that just hatches on the beach in Florida. That turtle, if you left it to its own devices, would head into the ocean and do a decade-long lap of the Atlantic, heading towards Europe and then back again to the US. If you expose that baby turtle to the kind of magnetic field it would experience at different parts of that journey, it will then swim in the right direction for that part of the world, even if it has never been in the water before. And that's, to me, incredible. You know, it has this sort of built-in magnetic sense, not only compass, but kind of a map of the Earth's magnetic field that would allow it to move over these continental distances.
A big question, an unanswered question, is how? Like, what is it in an animal, a turtle, a songbird, whatever, that allows them, what's their magnet nose?
Yeah, right. It's a fantastic question, because we, for other senses, we know the answer, right? Like with vision, I see with my eyes. I can tell you at great detail exactly the molecular things that are going on in my eyes that allow me to see. I can't tell you that for magnetoreception. I can't even tell you where the compass is in these animals. This is a subject of huge debate. There are lots of theories, but there's no conclusive answer yet. And partly that's because the magnetic field of the Earth moves through our flesh. So the organ that detects it doesn't need to be on the surface like an eye or an ear. It could be anywhere. It could be in the turtle's butt. It could be distributed throughout the turtle's body. And so finding it is incredibly hard. And it's not helped by the fact that magnetism is very counterintuitive. You know, it's hard to explain how it works. It's hard to explain how an animal might be able to sense it. And the magnetic field is incredibly faint. So whatever they're doing, you know, it's something quite special, and something that defies like the way we think about the senses normally.
Let's go back to our callers now. Angela is with us in Baraboo. Angela, hello.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I have a goose that I raised from a baby. She imprinted on me. And she was always very sweet and kind. But one day when I took her out of her enclosure, I was wearing my husband's jacket, which I didn't normally wear whenever I interacted with her. And she beat me up so bad. She scratched me. She hit me with her head. She pecked me. As soon as I took the jacket off, she was her usual sweet self. So,
what was the jacket, Angela?
Well, it was just a red flannel jacket, but it was something that I'd never worn before. And it was cold, so I just put it on, but she was unfamiliar with it.
Interesting. Angela, thanks for the call. Ed, clearly, in this case, a goose sensed something and didn't like it, which opens the door. Like, how do animals then interpret and take action based on some of their sensory input?
Right, right. And, you know, I should clarify for all of our listeners that I probably cannot explain to you why the animal in your life does the weird thing that it does. There are so many possibilities here, right? And I think that's part of like the joy of thinking about this topic. So was it something to do with smell? We know that birds, contrary to popular perception, do have a decent sense of smell. You know, was it something to do with color? The jacket might look red to Angela, but does it look to a different, something different to a goose? Probably, like something bad. I don't know. Right. Or like, is there something to do with sound, right? Is there something to do with the way the jacket is rustling? Like it's really hard to nail down any of these possible options. And probably, you know, Angela doesn't want to really test it out by by wearing the jacket more and risking another encounter. But I do think that what this says, and probably a lot of listeners have experiences like this, is that animals do sense things in strange ways and in ways that are different to what we sense and that can make their behavior very difficult to predict.
Thanks a lot for that call, Angela. We're talking to Ed Young about his new book, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. I want to talk about one we rely on a lot, Ed, and it's vision. And so I might think, okay, I see stuff, animals see stuff, I get it. I get what they're doing. Our eyes are really unique, and different animals, their whole eye systems are radically different. Can you share some of your favorites?
Yeah. So, you know, here's a very simple example. Our eyes face forward. So for the humans who can see, our visual world is in front of us and we move into it. But like a bird's visual world, say Angela's goose, it surrounds it. You know, its eyes are on the side, so it can see to the sides and probably a little bit behind. So its visual world is all around and it moves through it. You know, a duck sitting on a pond can probably see the entirety of the sky without needing to turn its head. And I think that's really remarkable. There are animals where different kinds of vision get distributed between different kinds of eyes. So some jumping spiders have more than one pair of eyes. There's one central pair that does like sharp, acute color vision. But then there's another pair to the side which handles movement. And if you block those eyes, the rest of the spider cannot detect things moving in front of them. Again, very, very unusual, very different from what we do. Our eyes are actually very unusual in being very, very sharp. Like we have excellent eyesight. Well, I mean, I don't. I wear bit, like heavy contacts. But like in general, humans have very good eyesight, surpassed only by eagles and other birds of prey. And if you think about the eyesight that other animals have, you realize that much of the world looks very different to them than to us. Like to a lion, from most distances, a zebra looks like a donkey. Lions can't see zebra stripes. They just fade into gray. So yeah, even with vision, even with the sense that I think at least sighted people are most familiar with and rely on the most, the sense that dominates our culture, our language, it's really different in probably the majority of other creatures.
One point I want to get to, Ed, before we run out of time, I think this is maybe a key takeaway from your book, is that understanding animals' senses can help us humans be better neighbors to them and figure out the ways that our behavior, our buildings, whatever, can really interfere with creatures in surprising ways. What kind of lessons do you hope we can learn from this?
Yeah, so, you know, in small ways we've already talked about, I think people can, you know, be better owners of their pets if they really think about their pets' senses and cater their behavior to the animals. But there are bigger consequences too of this tendency to assume animals live in the same umwelt as us. We flood the world with light and sound that distracts animals, that confuses them, that drives them away from habitats they would otherwise do really well in. These the consequences of this sensory pollution can be huge. You know, it can reduce pollination of plants. It can have fatal consequences for turtles and birds by diverting them into buildings or beaches instead of their migration paths or the sea. We don't really think of sensory pollution as a problem because we don't really think of light and noise as pollutants, but they very much are. And I think that we need to start preserving the dark and saving the quiet, much as we would want to save a rainforest or a coral reef. Doing so creates a world which is more hospitable to the animals around us, and I think makes us closer to nature. You know, in the early pandemic, when people stopped moving about so much and were much quieter, we heard a lot more birds around us. And that's because in quiet, we hear over longer distances and we hear more. We become more connected to the world around us. And I think that can only be a good thing.
Ed, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Ed Young, science writer at The Atlantic. He joins today for a look at his new book, An Immense World, How Animal Senses Reveal the Hidden Realms Around Us. A lot more senses and animals that he gets into in the book, and you could share your stories about animal perception or your curiosity about it. Email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, we'll look at an expected state Supreme Court ruling on the use of ballot drop boxes for voting here in Wisconsin. You can join in with your reactions to that decision and whether you think drop boxes should play a role in voting here in the state. Plus, it's this week's edition of Food Friday. A Wisconsin recipe expert shares great summertime dishes, plus some advice on meal prep for maximum flavor with minimum effort. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time on the Ideas Network. Coming up after the news, we talk about the search for meaning in our lives and how that's changed for some Americans over the past few years. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, U.S. Supreme Court is taking up a gerrymandering case that could have a wider impact on election law around the country. A law professor tells us what it could mean for elections in the future. First, if you're like a lot of people, you might be reevaluating your life, thinking about where you find meaning and how you spend your time. The Pew Research Center took a look at two surveys where they asked Americans where they find meaning in life. The surveys were 4 years apart, one in 2017, the other in 2021. They found some big, sometimes puzzling, changes. For example, people say they place less importance on their jobs. They're looking instead to the society around them, for better or worse. One of the biggest drops, fewer people said their spouse or romantic partner was a key source of meaning in their lives. We want to hear what you think at 800-642-1234. One, do you think about this? Do you think about where you go to find meaning in your life? If so, what is it? What gives your life meaning? Is it family, faith, job, recreational activities? I don't know. You tell us. Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Andrew Taggart is a practical philosopher and meditation teacher. He grew up in Platteville, finished his PhD at UW-Madison. Andrew, welcome back to Central Time.
So wonderful to be here, Rob. Thank you very much for having me.
The good news is we're not sorting out the meaning of life, but talking about how we find meaning in our lives. First of all, Andrew, why is it worthwhile for us to think about that, to think about what gives our lives meaning?
Meaning is probably the most basic question we can ask. And all of us ask this question at one point or another. Anytime a hardship arises, anytime we wonder about our relationships, anytime we're not sure about the way our life is heading, we're invariably asking the question about what it is that makes our life meaningful. You can't not ask this question at one point or another, it seems to me.
What kind of things do you find as the most common answers to that? Where do you see people going, either from the realm of philosophy or in their daily lives, that helps people find that meaning?
Yeah, let me begin very philosophically with a provisional definition so as to ground our discussion.
Sure.
So let me say that meaning, provisionally understood, refers to being in touch or in contact with some greater reality. I'm leaving off filling in what that greater reality is, but that will allow us to account for people who believe that being engaged in certain political causes is meaningful, or those who are involved in ecological matters, or indeed those who are involved in their faith. So what we're trying to do there is to ascertain whether or not someone actually is in contact with some greater reality. So I tend to find that, since I speak with a kind of subset of the population, that people are really turning quite incredibly right now toward religion and spirituality. But these are not the only answers they would give.
Now, this Pew study I mentioned, I don't know quite what to make of it. One thing that they didn't ask about is faith and spirituality. I think it's kind of rolled into a general social meaning kind of question. But what was interesting, it was kind of a pre-pandemic and in the midst of the pandemic survey. And one big drop was in, you know, people seeking satisfaction or meaning in their jobs, in their work lives. Does that strike you as surprising at all?
You're feeding me this question. We've talked about work in relation to meaning before, I think, some years ago. So no, it doesn't really strike me as surprising. I thought what was surprising, like you, though, is that many of the metrics they used or the categories used all suggest that people were down on it. They were down on society being a source of meaning, down on spouses and romantic partners being a source, down on finances and jobs, and down on physical and mental health, at least in the case of those who are older. So I think what we're starting to see here, and we can loop back in a moment to jobs, if you like, is a great sense of confusion that's coming over people, a great sense of perhaps being a bit lost when it comes to these matters. As a philosopher, I tend to think this is actually a blessing, a good thing, because it's confusion that helps us to actually reconsider, reevaluate the question so as to ask the question afresh. Wait, if it's not the case that, say, jobs are going to be the source of meaning in my life, then what will be? It opens up a space for genuine inquiry, I would say.
On the practical side of your practical philosophering, if someone is feeling that sense of, you know, maybe rudderlessness or the things that they thought were important not feeling so important anymore, what kind of questions can we start asking ourselves in that situation to chart maybe a new path?
So the first thing we can do there is to say something like, well, have we understood that, well, let's take jobs. I once thought, someone might say, that having an important career is going to be the basis for my life. And now I've come to realize that it is not. So what the person needs to start asking is, if that's not the case, then what could it be? And usually the person will go on to the next common category. It'll be relationships, as you just saw. So you might ask, well, what about relationships can make my life meaningful? And the person can start digging in there. But what if it's the case that someone has doubts about that? Then we'll start to see what looks like in the East called neti neti, which is an approach called not this, not this. It's not pleasant. In the West, we call it the way of negation. But that starts to generate a real keen interest in continuing to deepen the inquiry. And what you'll find is that if you do so with enough earnestness, that the answer will come. Now, the answer may be surprising to you. It might not be available to you at the outset, but the answer will arise.
We're talking to Andrew Taggart, a practical philosopher. You can follow him online. He blogs as The Practical Philosopher. We are talking about finding meaning in our lives. And we want to know, what does that mean to you? You could join in at 800-642-1234. When you look around at the different parts of your lives, a career, a family, a faith, involvement in maybe a political or ecological or other issue, what is it? What is it that you feel like gives your life meaning or direction? Or are you still trying to figure that out? If so, you are certainly not alone. You can join in with your thoughts, your reflections, maybe your questions for our guest at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew, getting back to that Pew study, one thing that was kind of interesting and maybe a little puzzling, more people from 2017 to 21 cited society or institutions or things like that as a source of meaning in their lives, but at the same time saying in kind of a negative way, they were worried about those things and finding, I don't know, them driven away from those kind of institutions. What did you make of that?
Oh, well, there's a longstanding issue when it comes to institutional life in the United States. But I think we can go back really to the onset of modernity and see, most especially, particularly after the German-English Enlightenment, that we have become increasingly skeptical of institutions, as being that which is authoritative over our lives. And certainly this got ramped up after Vietnam. So I don't know if this is quite surprising from a broad point of view, from a historical point of view. But if I can speak a little bit more concretely, my intuition would be to say also that people, especially during lockdowns, especially during a time when things have become more digitized, as it were, are actually experiencing a great deal of alienation from others, right? From the sentient, the contact with other beings. And you can say there's a certain kind of smallness of life that many of us have experienced, a kind of insularity. So we look on the outside and see that there is war in Ukraine, that there is inflation. We have a certain abstract sense that society matters, but the capacity to be in touch with other sentient beings, I think, is gone missing. So I would call that kind of following this line of thought alienation. And therefore, I would say people would cite society as being quite important. At the same time, they would say, however, it's had a negative impact on the life that I'm leading.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Dan is with us in Stevens Point. Dan, hi.
Hi there. What gives meaning to my life is, I hope, what I think I'm giving meaning to, which is my work on climate change. I am a volunteer, I have been for 10 years, with Citizens Climate Lobby here in Wisconsin. It's a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization working to keep this a livable planet. And I can't think of anything more important to do. All of us are going to feel the impact of climate change if we haven't already, and many of us have already. We need to work together, people of all parties, all religions, all backgrounds, to bring this under control for the good of the planet and for the good of all the people on it.
Dan, thanks a lot for calling in and sharing that. Andrew, that idea of seeing a problem in the world, getting together with others, and then working to solve a problem. That you were touching on that earlier as a one definite possible path for us to find meaning.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And the caller, Dan, I believe it is, mentioned that what brings it all together is that we wish to live on a livable planet. So if I may come back just for a moment to the understanding of a meaningful life, I would say that Dan, it seems, is living a meaningful life in virtue of having found something basic, something quite real, that pulls many dimensions of his life together and gives it a central organizing function. That, I think, is a characteristic formal feature, what we notice in people who report on having lived meaningful lives.
Dan, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Andrew Taggart, author and practical philosopher, has a PhD from UW-Madison, talking with Andrew about where and how people find meaning in their lives and how that might have changed over time. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Is this something you think about or have thought about? Did you change what you thought about the meaning in your life? What led to that change? Is there something that you would point to of the things you do, the people you interact with? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Andrew Taggart, a philosopher, talking about how and why people find meaning in their lives, how that might have changed maybe during the course of the pandemic for some people. You can join in now at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Over the course of the pandemic, did you rethink some big aspect of your life? Did something that used to seem important become less important to you? What filled that gap? What to you gives meaning in your life, your daily life, or the big picture? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. Andrew, sometimes reading the work of the big philosophers doesn't feel very practical while you're doing it. Do you have any sources of inspiration you might point toward for people, you know, thinking about this search for meaning in our lives?
Oh, certainly. I think one of the big philosophers here is the one that everyone listening would be familiar with, and that would be Socrates. Socrates was inviting us over and over and over again to ask these basic questions, like what is piety? What is virtue? What is justice? What is a good life? And he also helped us to see that we need to examine these matters very closely. And one of the things that's very interesting about the Socratic life is that he was arguing that the examination of the life is a key feature of meaningfulness. And I found that to be true myself. So if anyone listening finds that he or she or they are starting to turn over these matters and to make better sense of them, then this one is starting to find that meaning itself is already arriving on the scene.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Jim is with us in Madison. Jim, hi.
Hey. I taught middle school for 37 years, and I've been substituting post the pandemic. And one of the things that is conflicting for me is that the kids I'm working with seem to not really feel that there's much meaning to their existence. Outside of both technology and you know, they're really struggling with interpersonal relationships with one another. Kind of the rise of bullying, anti-empathy, and I'm just interested in what your guest has to say about that.
Jim, thanks for the call. The younger generation, Jim was working with middle schoolers there, Andrew.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is certainly a modern tradition of thought that goes by the name of philosophy for kids. So not unsurprisingly, this is a really great age in order to begin asking these big questions. So in lieu of assuming that the kids know the answer to the question about what is meaningful, it can be raised directly. If they're open to it, you can ask them things like, is chocolate cake meaningful? Is eating chocolate cake meaningful? Or is finishing a workout, which seems to be fulfilling, the same as being meaningful? That would be an interesting place to begin. And if you could begin to clarify what meaningfulness is, then you can begin to ask about the sorts of things that actually count as meaningful. For one thing, we really notice about people leading meaningful lives is that they have a clear sense of direction. Not that they're myopic or blindsided, but that they seem really focused, that there is something about their lives that gives it a kind of order, a harmony, a clarity. And so it would also be good as part of the exercise at hand to begin to point to some of those examples, to find some really wonderful shining examples of people who ostensibly are leading meaningful lives for the children to contemplate, to ponder, to see whether that is actually applicable to them.
Jim, hope that gives you some ideas if you go back to substituting in the fall. We're talking to philosopher Andrew Taggart about how we find meaning in our lives. Still time for you to share your answers at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Andrew, you were talking about the idea of the examined life and why we should ponder these questions and think about them. I think some people might say, no, my key to happiness is figuring out how to live in the moment and not be burdened with that kind of thinking. Is there something there?
I have a bit. I have a Zen Buddhist background too, so I can understand that reply. I would put the matter this way in order to split the difference between these two camps. If things are really going along swimmingly, if you're gardening, then you're gardening. If you're eating presently, then you're eating presently. If you're with others and you're attending to them, then you're with others and attending to them. This is really Zen speak, if you've heard a version of it before. However, there are times in our lives when confusions and bewilderments are really just tossed into the air, when we seem to be spun about. And at those times, Socrates would say, you might wish to examine what exactly is going on. So that's the way I would split the difference. I would say that if things are just carrying on nicely, if you are wu wei, as a Taoist would say, you're just flowing along with activities, things are intuitively clear to you, artistically clear to you, then so be it. But at those very moments, when things seem quite unclear, we have this wonderful gift bestowed to us. That is a gift of self-examination, the gift of being able to examine on our own and with others these matters so as to come to some resolution about them.
I want to throw in another state of being that I think probably a lot of people find familiar. It's not that sort of flow where you're present in the moment. It's not that conscious self-examination. It's, let's call it distraction. You're zooming down your social media feed or, you know, mindlessly watching a show after show. I'm not criticizing. I'm talking about me here. Andrew, that doesn't seem to me, when I'm doing it, like a healthy thing. How do I get myself into one of those other modes?
Well, hopefully, since we have a little bit of a Zen spirit at the moment, hopefully you will like a Zen joke. I once went to a teacher not too long ago, in fact, at the beginning of the pandemic, and I asked a question. It was different from that one. And he said, "You just stop it." He had kind of a French-English accent, if you can imagine that too. "You just stop it." Which is not entirely off the mark. This is basically the essence of meditation. We actually do have to be alert to or mindful of the ways in which we are wandering, dissipating our energy, losing our sense of what it is that matters to us. We have to be quite vigilant on that score. And then we just come back to what it is that truly does matter. So there's a reorientation that takes place over and over again. If you do that with the right effort often enough, with appropriate effort often enough, you'll find that the level of distractions will diminish and the capacity to really hone in on, to lock in on, to open yourself up to what is fundamentally meaningful will be clear to you. Will be clear to you in your actual experience.
Time for one more quick call with Steve in East Troy. Steve, hi.
Hi. You've been talking about meaning as a kind of a subjective thing that we make. I'd like to talk about it also as an objective thing that we don't make. For example, it comes out of the context of literature, and the meaning of a sentence, whether it makes you feel good or bad, has to do with how it fits in the larger context. And doesn't our meaning come not just from our making, but also is given to us or is discovered from the larger context? And it's kind of independent in that sense from how it makes us feel, whether
Steve,
good or bad.
Steve, I got to have to cut you off. Andrew, a huge question with about 40 seconds to answer it.
Oh, wow. Well, I actually agree with Steve. I was going off of the Pew Research, which was asking about how you find something right, meaningful, fulfilling, or satisfying. But I'm actually in the objective camp. Hence the definition very briefly was being in contact with something that is some greater reality. So I do think that we need to keep turning toward the objective conditions of life so as to find ourselves at rest in something larger than ourselves.
Steve, thanks for that question. And Andrew, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you very much for having me back.
Andrew Taggart is a practical philosopher and meditation teacher. He grew up in Platteville, finished his PhD at UW-Madison. We talked about the ways we find meaning in our lives, how it's changing for some people according to surveys, and where to find it. Coming up after the news, a law professor joins us to explain an upcoming U.S. Supreme Court case on gerrymandering that could shift the balance of power in election law. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.